You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So I have had more than my fair share of airtime here, so I'm going to turn it over to the University Librarian for Harvard, so I suspect also needing of no introduction, Professor Robert Darnton. And just by way of note, this is not being webcast, but it is being recorded for audio and will be put on the web. So same old rules apply, though there's not simultaneous, concurrent, whatever people are paying attention. Professor Darnton.
So I should be reasonably discreet.
You should be yourself, Bob.
Actually, what we had
and
in mind...
Jonathan Holbert from the Council's office didn't tell me to say anything relative to you and your comments in this stuff.
Was more an open conversation. But to give it some direction, we thought we would at least announce an overall subject. What is the overall subject, John?
Well, I think the overall subject, Bob, and then you get to say more about it, because I really am going to shut my mouth for as much as possible, is the idea of paying by the drink for activities in a library rather than owning everything and then giving it out. So if you scroll back in your history of the book world, age in which a library made selections of books, acquired them, admitted them to the collection and then rendered them accessible by handing them over to patrons, being the paradigmatic example of the, call it, 19th century library model, to today's hybrid, where we do some of that, plus providing digital access to things that sometimes we have only a series of rights in, and then potentially heading to an awkward future where predominantly we... maybe even large research libraries like our own, but certainly lots of libraries end up not acquiring anything other than the rights to access certain information, and where the service rendered by the library is in part directing people to these works rather than holding them in any meaningful sense. So that's the question. Obviously, the Google Book search settlement raises a very large specter. One aspect of the specter, which you've written a fair amount about and spoken a lot about, is imagine this, the access to all of these works governed by this settlement, to which we as university librarians have basically no choice but to give access to our users. Certainly at a university like this, it would be very hard not to pay for that, and yet, obviously, with some pricing pressure, they're quite possible. And then you might think of it in the other aspect of the decision tree being not even about the Google thing, but just simply that we are increasingly beholden to the Elseviers and other large publishers on a subscription-type basis rather than a buy-it-and-keep-it-type basis. So, there we go.
Thanks. Just what I wanted to say.
Excellent.
Oh, no, you tricked me. So, we're facing enormous problems of financing libraries, obviously, and probably judging from the nodding heads, everyone has been in this one way or the other, so I won't spend a lot of time pounding my chest and wailing. But life is getting more and more difficult for libraries by the minute, and we are acquiring fewer and fewer books, and yet we're trying to venture farther and farther into the digital world. I think John is right when he says maybe you didn't attach a number of years to it, maybe 10 years, 15 years from now, that the dominant mode of communicating, let us say monographs, never mind journals, will be electronically. If I'll just tell one quick anecdote that I've stumbled upon recently that I find interesting, because I always go to the past to try to look into the future. And there was a wonderful futuristic utopian novel published in 1771 called The Year 2440, in which the author falls asleep. He wakes up in the year 2440, and one of the first things he says, it's a Rip Van Winkle effect, take me to your library. So he's taken to the library, and he expects it to look like, this is a French novel, like the Bibliothèque du Roi, you know, with just more books that you could possibly imagine. And instead, there's one room with four tiny cabinets. And he says, well, what happened? And the librarian in this futuristic society said, well, we burned all the books. You burned them? Yes, we took a committee of sage men of letters, and they read everything and distilled it down to the basic truth and moral lessons. And so we got rid of the rest, and then he gives numbers, you know, 1 billion novels, 500,000 travel books, etc., etc. But after reading this, I thought, you know, that's suspiciously resembles the futuristic world that a lot of people imagine, of libraries without books, and indeed Google Book Search, you know, you just tune in and you have the digital library available. So instead of the four little...
It's a bunch of servers or...
Yeah, they're servers. And it has an uncanny resemblance to that. Well, I don't think that...
Can you put Wikipedia on one of those servers, the backup of Wikipedia?
I don't think we will ever have libraries like that, but certainly, I mean, all of you, those of you who've written books and journal articles, I'm sure wrote them on computers. They were sent off and kept in an electronic file of some one sort or other. Then maybe they were processed and printed, but it could be that in the very near future, so much print on demand will exist that most books will never pass through some kind of warehouse provided by the publisher, that all of these, many of these intermediate stages will be eliminated, and that you will download directly from a database kept by the publisher, or maybe by Google, because Google is now moving into, Google's a bookstore, a gigantic digital bookstore, so maybe you'll get it from Google. In any case, all of this will take place in the digital, through a digital medium, and then you might have something like the new espresso book machines that you probably read about, which can, in 5 to 10 minutes, print out and bind a 300-page book. So I don't think that future is terribly far away, and we have to take that into account in our planning. But at the same time, we have solid statistics saying every year more printed monographs, new ones, are produced than in the previous year. So we've got the continued growth of printed books while this digital future seems to loom larger and larger. As I see it, we have to get through a transitional phase. And that means we cannot, at least not here at Harvard, slacken in our acquisitions of printed books. I think it's our responsibility to not just ourselves, but also future generations. And yet we have to buy more and more digital data sets and provide more digital services. How to do this, how to cope with things on two fronts is a major problem for libraries now, not to mention the problem of digital preservation and so on, which obsesses us here at Harvard. So, I mean, I'm probably telling you things you already know, but the financial pressures, not to mention the fact that the sky fell a few months ago, at least it fell on Harvard, but really on all libraries, has created a situation that is, maybe desperate is too big a word, but it's very, very critical. And along comes the Google Book Search business at the same time, so everything seems to be fluid, and this is a moment when we can make major changes. What should they be? Well, pay by the drink is one suggestion. And to give, I hope I'm not revealing anything untoward.
We'll find out later, man.
But the head of the medical school library, the Countway Library, was told by his dean, you must reduce your budget by 10%. And around almost on the same day, he received a notice from Elsevier saying, we're increasing the prices of our journals by 10%. How could he cope with that situation? I mean, he absolutely couldn't do it. And well, there were lots of talks, there was a lot of back and forth, and finally the dean relented. And so the Elsevier subscriptions are continuing at the medical school. But that's patchwork, you know, that's getting us through the last fiscal year. What's going to happen in this fiscal year, what's going to happen in fiscal 10, Good, so please interrupt, because I...
The Harvard Medical School wants to start. Hold on.
I'm going to play the... hold on a second. Because we are recording. Hello?
I think it's at the very bottom underneath. Yeah.
There we go. Sorry, that's it. Hold on.
Yep.
Right. I was just going to say that's kind of their average anyway. That's the annual increase. So it wasn't anything unusual in this situation.
Right. Which makes me all the more worried, because obviously it's a structural problem. We have to do something about it. So that's one thing I'd like to toss out for general discussion. What should we do about it? We at the Harvard University Library, if you take the big three, Elsevier, Springer, and Wiley, we spend, just for their journals, $2.7 million a year. I mean, that's an enormous sum of money just for these three publishers for their journals. I don't think we can go on indefinitely like this. So what should we do? Well, one proposal is pay by the drink. That is, whenever a student or a faculty member wants to consult an article, we will pay for it, but we won't subscribe to the journal. And Caltech has negotiated a deal with Elsevier, actually, to do just that. So that's one possibility. There are other possibilities, but maybe instead of haranguing you, I should ask whether you have ideas and or questions.
I was going to stick it to Dr. Lambert here. You're not going to jump in yet.
I could mention, I mean, if you would like some other contentious things, I could toss, I could toss them out, but I'd rather hear from you.
That's good. We've got these three people on the front here. And we're using this only so that it stays recorded, if that's okay.
Sure. I am a library director. I just wanted to quick respond to, I mean, yes, that's business as usual, but we are in unusual times, and so a 10% raise in this fiscal year is unacceptable, I believe.
I didn't mean that I thought it was fine. I just meant that it wasn't as unusual as it might convey.
Right. I think the conversations we need to be having with our providers of resources now are different than the conversations we've had with them for, well, in my history of negotiating with vendors. And it's not just, gee, the price can't go up 10% this year. It's a fundamental shift in how are we getting our information. And you're right, is it going to have to be paid by the drink? I work for my boss is a mathematician in his beginning. He's a smart person. I report to someone who used to be a mathematician. And so as I'm, you know, buying fewer books, and we are buying fewer books to buy more electronic resources, he says, well, that's not sustainable, because the average price of a book stays pretty steady over time, but the price of these resources keep going up. And so, in fact, we're going to be losing collections and not continuing to build the collections as we were in the past when we were able to purchase more physical collections.
What are you going to do about it? How are you going to cope with this? Because it's, as I said, a structural problem. And are you simply going to cut back on monographs?
We have cut back on monographs.
Or staff, right? There are lots of other things you can cut back on other than collections,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we're fortunate in the staff area. We're so small that there's no place to go with our staff. But
that's the nervous laugh. That's how you say you can't cut us further.
We have three staff.
Oh, I see.
At a college library.
Yeah.
But anyway, the conversations we've had have been much more serious, and actually they've been successful for this year. But that's a one-off patch, and so what's going to happen the next year or the following year? And that's what I'm much more worried about. And that I am hoping that this buys us the time for the models to shift. Publishing is changing. And I'm are there publishers in the room? Because the publishing models and publishers' relationships with libraries simply must change. And it can't just be the prices are somehow going to go up and our collections are going to shrink. Has to be another answer.
Should we share the mic around here?
This may not be a deep enough question for this group, but just out of curiosity, I'm curious what excuse or reason, I should say, that these other publishers give for raising their rates, because publishing physical costs are actually going down in terms of the physical amount of paper or other materials. And so where is that money going? Is it going, where is it being used, this extra 10% a year? So just out of curiosity, and is that a real cost, or is that sort of an illusionary cost, and maybe that can come into this formula of trying to come up with a better solution for, you know, pay by the drink, something like that.
Well, Elsevier officially announced a profit of $1.5 billion last year.
That's where it's going.
So that's where a lot of this is going. Now, if there were a representative of Elsevier here, I'm sure that he or she would come up with some rhetoric that would make us possibly feel better. They do say things such as, we have the greatest journals, we have an excellent product, you've got, if you're a serious scientist, to buy these journals to stay on top of your field. We organize peer review, we are good editors, and we publish things in glorious color, which is very important for some forms of science, medicine, and technology, because you can follow things in the graphs and so on. I find this very unconvincing, and when they also demand that we buy bundles, as they put it, which include journals that we don't especially want, I find this unreasonable. So I think that there's a tremendous argument to be made against these huge commercial publishers, and we tried to make the argument. We failed, and it's not just because we're too nice at Harvard to stand up to Elsevier, but rather that they have negotiating techniques that are tough to match. For example, Springer, I don't know if you followed this episode, Springer sells a vast amount of its scientific journals to the Max Planck Institutes in Germany. Now, scientific research is done in these Max Planck Institutes, which are fabulous places scattered all over Germany. It's really crack research. And they objected to being, as they saw it, victimized by extortionate pricing. And so they tried to negotiate lower prices. And Elsevier wouldn't budge. Springer would not budge. So they said, we cancel all of our subscriptions. They just pow! One, you know, right in the kisser. And I remember reading about this and rejoicing and thinking, maybe at Harvard we should at least issue a press release and we're considering doing the same thing, just considering to try to build up some momentum of opposition to this extortionate, as I see it, pricing. Well, about 3 months later, Springer settled, the Max Planck Institute settled with Springer. Now, you know, you have to read the fine print of the settlement. The Max Planck people, possibly to save face, said we didn't really give in too much. But I think I could be wrong, but I think the protests by the scientists were so vehement that they just felt, well, we had no choice but to subscribe. If we tried to cancel in the Harvard University Library our subscriptions to these big three, I think there would be a revolt on the part of the scientific sector of the faculty.
Tom, do you want to take it first in there?
Okay. Well, I recall that there was an email sent out to a lot of the collections people whether they wanted to boycott Springer too, just along with the Max Planck Institute. So, but I think the fact is they know we need their products. So they have something we want. I mean, I don't know how we, you know what I mean? Even if we were to gather together, they know they have something that we need. So, I mean, I think that's what makes it really hard to negotiate with them. Not necessarily that they're great at it, because we have managed at the medical school that, like, things that we were kind of marginally interested in, and they were like, yeah, we want this amount, and we're like, okay, fine. And then we don't want it. And then they came back and said, oh, yeah, we'll give you 30% off what we first said. So they are willing to, as long as you are willing to walk away. And I think the problem is they know they have us. They know that we need these resources. So I think that's part of the problem. We need it.
Yeah. You know, this is such a fascinating problem. And I've often thought that with the NFL, that the colleges are in such a good position to say, we're supplying all of your talent. wanting to just pay us because we were training ground and everything.
Training ground and the games. I mean, in college.
And right? In college, yeah. Yeah. But they do get paid for that. But obviously the analogy and the reference I'm making here is that you universities are not just consumers. You're supplying much of the content.
Sure.
Obviously. So it just really invites some global solution on behalf of you content providers, although there would be antitrust implications as well if you sat down and tried to figure out how to do some bargaining together. Open access journals are obviously a cut at that, but right now we're a very small cut. And Science Commons, a division of Creative Commons, is involved in some of this.
An example of this, Eric, you and I, both coming from this particular environment, know well that the law school is sort of the perfect leading edge of this, or thin end of the wedge, right? In the sense that if you think about law publishing, we as the researchers are the talent, right? We publish very few practicing lawyers in journals, generally. Secondly, we actually are the publishers, right? If almost every journal, relevant journal in law, published by a law school, a law review, or other journals, right? And then lastly, we are the customers. We are the ones who do most of the subscribing. I don't know if it's actually most, but I would guess that there are more subscriptions from university libraries than from law firms and other libraries, right? And yet we still haven't cracked this ourselves when we have every bit of this process, right? Now, I believe that through our open access mandate and so forth, we will get there in the law schools, and I think we will get there first. But nobody, as far as I know, no law school has followed Harvard Law School's faculty mandate, and the only thing I've heard back about Harvard's mandate is some people saying it's too watered down because you can opt out, right? It hasn't been a groundswell of this, even where it's easy. Much less the places where it's super hard, which is the medical school and elsewhere, for a variety of different complicated dynamics. So I completely agree with you. My sense is this is a classic example where we have to look back at ourselves and say, why are we as universities not fixing this and now, and doing it with all possible speed, and especially in the places where it should be easy structurally?
Just two quick points, just to put a bow around this. So many of you are from Harvard, and probably you all know what John is referring to about the vote that the Harvard faculty made to give a license to president fellows of the university for all original published research
journals
in journals. In journals. But the other point is most universities. In terms of intellectual output, think that they, and maybe individual authors think as well, that they are going to have a net benefit by getting paid, in the case of journals, quite little. But it turns out that with universities, they are not mostly net recipients of cash for their scientific discoveries. There's a net outflow. Here it just seems like terrible net outflow. And the thing I would ask you to keep your minds on in the future is not just the published journal articles, but I and many others are sort of looking at the issue that Elsevier and others are really down the line as interested in the data mining as they are in the published research. And that's, I think, the double whammy that's around the corner.
Yeah. Well, I think we... go ahead, Sue. While the microphone is on its way, I should say that we all accept the argument that we, the scholars, produce the material, we serve as referees for it, we serve on the editorial boards, and then we buy it back again through our libraries, that this is wildly irrational. Still, we have to find some kind of solution to this fundamental problem.
Yeah, and just to sort of tie on to this idea, I know that around the same time the Harvard Law School voted in for the scholarly communication, Harvard opened an office for scholarly communication. And I'm wondering if anybody can comment if they've heard anything about how this has been moving forward, not just here, but I'm sorry, Mackenzie Smith from MIT was at the session this morning. She was leading another breakout. But I'd also be interested to hear how DSpace has been moving at different institutions. A lot of folks have adopted DSpace, but the last I was sort of looking at this, it wasn't widely popular. I mean, DSpace is a great repository, supposed to be a storage space for faculty publications, workings of universities, anybody who sort of wants to store stuff. But I think folks have had a very hard time convincing people to put their content into these shared
storage repositories. And I think there's sort of this mindset of the creators that is going to need to be changed in order for all of the other, you know, how are we getting our content back out, has to be changed as well.
I wonder if the colleagues here left from the MIT Press, have you been involved in the open access journals bit at all?
I work in the books. I work in the books division.
Yeah.
I don't do very much with journals. I'm also a librarian. I just have a master's program. And so I'm wearing two hats as a publisher. The journals that we've made some efforts into looking at open access journals, I can't represent the journals department. I feel very strongly about open access, and I published various books under Creative Commons licenses, which have been, we're working to see how that works financially. There are challenges for us to do that as we have to cover our costs. So we're waiting to see how the jury's still out on how that works. In terms of the journals, I guess our journals, new journals with Dr. Simmons, so what the future will be. Is there a more specific question?
Oh, no, I just thought possibly if you wanted to talk about that, because MIT then followed on to our vote, and I know also,
yes.
Having been publishing with you also, that there are the International Journal of Learning and Media and a bunch of other experiments you guys have done have been about one piece in that puzzle. But
the IJLM journal is a new venture from the MacArthur Foundation, and that's that just launched in January. So we're really hoping that that will be a new model for our journals program, and we're hoping to have as much online content that is actually not available, but that is only available in a rich media format. So we're hoping that, and I think that model lends itself very well to a lot of the journals that we publish in, whereas a really dumbed down diagram of an fMRI process really doesn't capture, you know, where you could have a moving image or some kind of thing like that. I think the larger for-profit publishers like Elsevier, Springer, and Wiley are able to make better forays into this, as they have the resources to do these things, but I think university presses would like to be able to do this as well. We're just, it's harder for us to find resources. That said, I think if anyone is involved in the scholarly journal societies that are able to encourage your journals to stay with university press, I encourage you to do that. That's a lot of scholarly societies have moved away over to Elsevier and Wiley and places like that, and that obviously they offer very different resources than we can offer due to the money that they have, but there's been some heartbreaking losses for university presses. University of California lost all of the Anthropology Association. I think they have six or eight journals. Do you remember? I'm not sure if you remember that.
Sorry to hear it.
Okay, they had a very large set of journals for the Anthropology Association, and they had created this really great digital product to support these things and spent a lot of resources doing this, and then ultimately they ended up moving over to, I think it was possibly Blackwell, which is now Wiley. So, there's a lot of, there's a few other examples like that.
Yeah. So I agree. I think there's a real drift into the arms of the big commercial publishers who can tempt small associations often by saying, we'll take over your journal, you provide the content and so on, but we'll give you a good return. And so there is consolidation and even some would say monopolization. I have a suggestion to toss out for debate. I don't know whether you would find this interesting or not, but we are considering trying to promote open access journals by subsidizing processing fees. Now, as probably a lot of you know, nearly half of the open access journals charge processing fees, sometimes wrongly called author's fees. In other words, you write an article, you send it off to the journal, and if it's the Public Library of Science Biology, they say that will be $2,850, please. That's the cost of processing an article to you, the author, which is very shocking to most of us who don't feel that we ought to pay to get published in the scholarly journals. But in fact, over half of the for-profit journals also charge processing fees. It's a very widespread practice. Now, could we take this practice and use it in order to promote open access publishing? That is to say, we at Harvard are considering subsidizing processing fees to the authors of scholarly articles, provided those articles go to open access journals. And we've tried some calculations. We feel that for $3,000 a professor, we might be able to do it, a cap of $3,000, because many grants in the hard sciences include provision for processing fees. That's quite normal in many cases, especially in the medical sciences. The Wellcome Foundation has now agreed to make that standard, if I understand correctly. The NSF and the NIH grants all include this kind of a processing fee. So a lot of the faculty, at least at Harvard, would already have this money provided for them, and the others, well, maybe we could afford it. It's hard times, but if this is a significant step in reversing the whole model of the economics for publishing scholarly journals, it would, I think, be worth it. But you could say, oh well, only a rich university could afford this kind of a policy. We're including in it subsidies to the journals themselves to pay for the processing fees of authors in colleges and universities where they cannot afford it, including third world or developing countries, etc. So this is a serious proposal that we are trying to launch, and if we can get enough, a sufficient number of other universities to cooperate, this could begin to build up a momentum, and the journals themselves would see that it would be to their advantage to switch from a model in which the payment comes from the production end rather than the consumption end. I don't know what you think of this.
Well, I'd be interested in Marguerite's continued view. Do you mind talking this? Because, I mean, also in the context of the book that we're publishing with you, we put up a bunch of money from our research funds, right, to produce it as an open access book. I don't know how much you're willing or able to talk about that. But it seems there's a relevance between these.
A little
books,
bit.
Right?
I think with that book, we there is no the royalties were waived to make it open access. So that was, and all the research is posted and available online right now before the book will actually be out. So I think there's that makes up a special case.
It is a special case. There's also the case that in the, as here we forked over some money in addition to not taking the royalties, right? In
that
order to get
the
process.
That was actually but with the my concern with the just the overall giving paying a fee to make something open access, I guess I worry that that's essentially just going into depending on the situation that's not encouraging the publisher to change their model, their price, their model. If you're just it's obviously more complex than that, but just in a very conductive sense, if it's just paying someone $3,000 to make your journal article open access, that's not, I want the funds to be earmarked for, not just to cover the publisher's bottom line. If it's, we're talking about an Elsevier or a Weisinger, even a press like ours, like it needs to, there's, the whole process needs to be rethought.
So
the requirement is that the article be published in an open access journal. So the idea is to reinforce open access journals, to strengthen them, and especially if they have high quality articles, to build up a shift towards that separate model.
I haven't been paying very much attention in terms of IB and the big three, as we call them. Are they doing open access journals? Are they allowing?
No, although they see this as a threat, and so they have developed what they call a hybrid model. In other words, they say, if you want to pay us to publish your article, we're delighted. And we will make your article in our electronic edition available free.
So that just sort of seems to be encouraging their standard procedure, usual, but if you pay us off, then we'll let you do it.
So our proposal is to not allow subsidies that would go to hybrid, so-called hybrid journals.
So the whole journal itself would have to be double-indexed.
That's right. So I mean, the point here would be to support the IJLM model. Right? The whole notion would be to say, to encourage publishers to do what you're doing in that case, and instead of being the MacArthur Foundation subsidizing it, it would be the universities as doing that. So are we getting it wrong? I mean, this would actually be a great time for a publisher to stand up and say, you're screwing up the incentives, don't do this. But so you would support this proposal at some foundation if you were...
I cannot speak for the journals. Yeah.
Great. Maybe you can send it down to Dr. W. over there, who's now going to take up my challenge.
Yeah. I sort of feel obliged to. Uh-huh. First of all, it's really interesting that the discussion about libraries, which are typically consumers, has turned into a discussion of what universities and libraries as producers.
Some of us believe that's part of what libraries ought to do if we don't already.
And I'm wondering whether on the other side of the production, of the producer sort of calculus, the supply side, whether anything's going on to try to increase the perceived value of publishing in open access journals, since the claim of the four-page journals is that they are the prestige journals and tenure committees pay more attention to them. Is there anything being done culturally or in a structural way to increase the perceived value?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I don't have an adequate answer to it, I'm afraid. A lot of this turns on, especially the hard sciences and the prestige system, the reward system, the way careers are made in physics and chemistry and the medical sciences as well. So that I'm told constantly by these people it matters so much that I get published in Cell or Nature that I can't afford not to do it. Or if there is a very well-known senior professor in molecular biology who is high-minded about open access and says, right, my lab is going to publish in an open access journal, it's the postdoc who suffers because the postdoc wants the prestige of publishing in Cell. It's a very complex world out there. But what I do see a few positive symptoms of change. One is Scope 3. I don't know if you followed Scope 3, but Scope 3 was originated by the physicists at CERN at Geneva. And they too thought it was outrageous that they should produce all of this fabulous new scientific information, that they should serve as referees and on editorial boards and then have to buy the stuff back at outrageous prices. So they said, let's, again, reverse the whole process and persuade libraries and other physicists and physical societies to pool their money and to calculate the cost of a high quality journal, allowing enough for a reasonable profit, but controlling the profit because the control would be exerted from the production end. And they actually built up a lot of support in Europe. They then came to California and tried it out at the meeting of the National Association of Physicists. And the association split, apparently. I hope my information is correct. I do know physicists
Someone
here at Harvard.
Googling it right now, and we'll get you if you're wrong.
Okay. Who, you know, have reservations about this. But I must say, to me, it sounded like an excellent idea. And I think there will be more and more things of this sort in which learned societies will publish their own journals and will provide the costs. And you can do it even for profit, allowing a reasonable profit. What we want to prevent is runaway pricing. And we certainly suffered enough from it. And frankly, people tell me I shouldn't buy this analogy. But that's one of the reasons I'm so worried about Google Book Search. Because we have already been victimized by the publishers of journals. Will this same thing happen in which we have the digital, fabulous digital library created by Google, who will also ratchet up the prices, and the product will be so good we can't afford not to buy it. So I think it is a moment when we should try to take charge of things instead of simply suffering the price mechanisms foisted on us by the producers.
would say, David, one of the, just response to this, I think one of the keys on the prestige side is the provosts and presidents, I suppose, in certain universities. So we're very lucky that Steve Hyman, the provost here, is a huge open access advocate. And he has said many times publicly, in particular in the context of the task force on libraries that Bob and I are serving on this year, that he affirmatively, in the context of an ad hoc proceeding, which at Harvard the process generally is your department or school votes on you, and if you make it through that version of the vote, it goes to the president or the provost, who one of the other does an ad hoc review, where they bring in faculty members from other schools and so forth to review. And he said affirmatively, something in Open Access Journal we like, right? He says, certainly don't discriminate against it. And if every provost told every committee chairman that, and down the line, at every university, and we all joined in this, I think the collective action problem would be solved on that score. And if the MIT presses the world publish peer-reviewed, as IJLM is, great journals, and then get good people to put in it, we can break the back of this. I really think we can. Now, it may take a while. There'll be transitional cases. People will get, some postdocs will get, lose out in the meantime. I'm not saying there won't be calamities in the process, but I don't think it's implausible if provosts and presidents and presses and so forth and, you know, chairs of various committees stood up and did it.
A follow-up question. Is there anything going on already providing a relatively standardized way of measuring the, not just the citation list as an indication of the success of an article, effectiveness of an article, but looking more broadly at social effect of what gets published particularly online. So we can, somebody can say, well, sure, it wasn't in sale, but it was cited, it was blogged, it was served as a...
Well, of course, there are, as you know, all kinds of citation indexes. But that's, I gather you're asking, is there something beyond the sheer counting of references that measures influence, qualification of thing? And I must say, I don't know of such a thing. It could be because the demand is there. But I think a lot of people would argue in the hard sciences that the public library of science, which is open access, is the very top quality. So if we can get more senior scientists committed to this sort of thing, I think that's half the battle. And we need to work on them. But there are some leaders out there in the world of science who are willing to, well, take the lead and not victimize their postdocs, but to really stick their necks out. So I'm cautiously optimistic about this. And you might even now extend the issue and say, what about subsidizing the publishing of monographs? You know, should the monographs also in the human sciences be subsidized at the production end? And there I would think that people in university presses would gulp in horror at this notion. But of course university presses are coming under more and more financial pressure as well. I mean, this everything is connected with everything else in the world of knowledge. And so it could be that university presses in the long run will follow this same direction. I mean, if everything is moving toward open access and we get mobilized so that we concentrate our resources to further the spread of knowledge, which is what it's all about, instead of simply leaving it to businesses to take charge, I think we really would have a much better world.
Eric, just to answer David, I know that on the Science Commons website, and if you can't find it, then a quick email to John Wilbanks. They have studied this, and maybe you know about this, but they show the influence of open access journals and how many more times, I know this isn't a complete answer of the influence, open access journal pieces are cited elsewhere, including in proprietary journals than our proprietary journal articles. So the sort of speed of the vigorish going around is faster than open access journals. And, but for other influences, you could ask John.
Yeah, in sheer numbers, the articles that appear in open access journals are cited far more often than in closed journals.
And there are also betas within SSRN, for instance, and others that are sort of looking at these kinds of issues, but I think they're more accounting related than they are really kind of weighted.
It sounds like we need an acceleration measurement.
I think that's true. That's true.
We've been talking a little bit about tenure, at least that's been the implied conversation. I think a parallel conversation there is accreditation. It would be nice to hit this at a larger level, because then it doesn't have to just be Harvard and MIT and Olin. And school by school, you could actually hit, you know, New England and NEASC or something like that, where it, when I went through my ABET, my engineering accreditation, my visit comprised of them walking into the library, looking at my journal shelf, seeing that I had a certain society's journal sitting on the wall and saying, you're good. And that was that. I was tremendously disappointed. I put months into this visit. And I just had to write a check. and so I think that that's another area where we as libraries and also institutions can work with groups to change the perception and what works and what is important, where our scholarship is published.
How would you go about that? Would you concentrate on professional associations or accrediting societies?
Accrediting societies, I imagine, but I would think we have to do that in partnership. Schools getting together to talk to the accrediting bodies. I know that NEASC standards were changed a few years ago, but they probably need further changing.
So I just want to take a pause here for 1 second, partway through, and just to acknowledge, we started with the notion of what it's like, these changing modes of paying for information, the changing role that libraries are going to have, and does the Google Books element make us think differently about this and so forth. And we skidded very quickly into the open access discussion and have stayed there. I'm delighted about the open access discussion. It's one we work on a lot. But I wanted to acknowledge that and say, are there other aspects of this, both sort of pricing and consumption model, that we want to hit on while we're here? But the other would be to say, I was grabbed by one of the Berkman interns earlier in the hall, who said there's too little dissent here at this conference, which is fair enough, that we all seem to be preaching to the choir or to one another. And I want to just acknowledge that if anybody wants to speak out either against open access, a general idea, or maybe more specifically to say open access is wrong-headed or the wrong answer to the questions that we started with. So just to privilege any voices of that sort. Or to take it another direction. And if not, we can just revert to open access. But Tom,
I'm far from liking or defending the vendors, but I remember in one of the other sessions earlier, someone said, you know, what good is it having the information if people can't access it? And I think one of the things they do kind of well, some of them anyways, to provide good interfaces to help, you know, searching and things like that. And I wonder how that would work for an open access model. Like, who would be maintaining these things? Who would be, because a lot of the problems we deal with are just maintenance issues, a lot of, you know, with a lot of these vendors. Mm-hmm. And how would that work with open access? I mean, would you hire more people to work on these things? And then would that drive up cost because you have more people having to maintain things, develop better products? So I don't know how that would affect things.
Well, I think it would be very naive to believe that there aren't serious costs in putting out a journal. So in saying, you know, we academics do all the work and then referee it and then have to buy it back again, that really does oversimplify things. And especially when it comes to electronic publishing, which there's this tendency to think, well, it's for free, basically. But it isn't for free. And depending on the subject, there's a lot of editorial expertise. There are great value added, as it's called in the world of publishers. So that is a very serious problem. And to it, you should add the problem of preservation, because it seems to me that libraries should commit themselves to preserving electronic material. But we then have to decide what's worth preserving and what isn't worth preserving, especially as we get deeper into the world of so-called gray literature that will be made available on the repositories we're creating. So I don't have an easy answer to it, but I think that this will be part of the pricing structure of an open access journal or an open access university press. There's a question back there.
Why are the problems with journal pricing so extreme now as opposed to in the past? Is it just because we don't own any of the content anymore, and so we're renting it all? Or is there something else going on that wasn't an issue, you know, 20 years ago when we were buying physical journals? And is there a possibility of buying the digital files and keeping them at the institution if the institution has that kind of infrastructure?
Well, I'm all for actually creating the digital files in repositories ourselves. In fact, that's what we're doing now. But the question as to the history of the price rises, I've done a little bit of study of that. I'm no great expert, so you know, we should discount a bit what I say. But it's certain that this began in the 1980s to rise very severely. And I've got a bunch of graphs and so on which show the price of journals really skyrocketing relative to the price of monographs and relative to a price index. And it became spectacular in the 1990s, around the turn of the century. And recently, it's actually leveled off a little bit. But libraries have to spend more money on journals than ever because new journals are being created all the time. And one of the strategies of the publishers is not necessarily to raise the price of each individual journal, but to create more journals, and you've got a general fragmentation in the world of research. So the number of journals is just astonishing. And I think that Eric's point, he's left, but his point about the ambition of these big publishers to not only make money from selling subscriptions to their online journals, which means we rent access to the digitized copies, we don't own them, but also to exploit databases and the data itself that is being accumulated within the journals. I suspect that some of the really big publishers will begin to provide search services and even a kind of digital libraries of a Google sort.
Well, Bob, let me suggest that if there are any lawyers in the room, imagine this world, right, in which you have a whole lot of public domain materials published by the United States government, right, and a bunch of other things that are put into a database, and a wonderful search engine is put on top of it and then sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, even in the form of two services to every library and law firm, right? Sounds a lot like what Elsevier sells through LexisNexis and Westlaw, right? So it's not a future thing. I think it's a now thing. It's very clearly an, you know, a huge driver of the kinds of profits that they're seeing.
Yeah, I agree that it is. All the more reason to try to stop the drive and to transform it. And, you know, there is a bill in Congress being prepared to require that any research of any kind, not just medical kind, subsidized by the government, be made available open access. So there are currents pushing in this direction.
Margaret, I don't know, do you want to speak at all for your kin in the publishing world about rising costs? I know you're not a journals person and you're at a university press, but is there a channel, the argument that a publisher might make at this moment when pressured on the cost point?
I think in the rise of costs with journals, as you were pointing out, rising in the 80s, I think some of this has to do with the taking on more technology to support the journals. I don't know how that speaks to the profits of the scholars, so obviously it's not that support that's necessary to cover those costs. But in terms of cost, I mean, there's a general rising of costs for materials, but generally speaking, that can I think we're seeing more price sensitivity where we used to assume that we would publish, you know, an average print run for a scholarly monograph would be 1,000 copies of the book, and we would assume 750 of those copies would go to libraries. That's not the case anymore. With interlibrary loan as well as electronic viewing of books, that's certainly not the case. So that changes the economics considerably.
Are you willing to say what you put in a spreadsheet for a new book to resume library purchases instead of 750?
I still have to make the case to publish a book. I still have to make the case that that's something that I would sell 1,000 copies of the book in 3 years, and that's certainly not the case.
But if we could draw you out, I've been through this with. I've been on boards of other publishing houses.
You're not the only one getting this kind of question from Professor Darden.
So we used to, at the Princeton University Press, very good press, we used to assume that we could sell 800 copies to libraries.
And Margaret just said 750, just, right?
No.
Just to libraries?
Yes.
I think we hope that we'll have individual sales of 350 copies.
Yeah.
Right, so she's saying,
we don't actually have, but that this is not any number I've ever seen before. This is just a little long.
Well, we've gone at Princeton. The estimate was—it's a very ballpark type estimate, but you could count on 800 copies sold to libraries, and then quite a few sold to individuals, and you easily cover your costs. And now the figure is not 800, but 400, 300, sometimes 200—not nearly enough to cover costs. Now at the MIT Press. I haven't followed it in detail, but you now report to the library. Do you think that university presses should be part of an expanded library function?
Well, as you pointed out, we already are technically part of that. I mean, I see opportunities for more connections between the library and the press. I think what libraries do very well is they do large-scale systems for technology, which would, if we were trying to do some sort of electronic book product or anything like that, anything with enhanced search capability, the library would be an obvious partner for that, as you already have the infrastructure for such things. If we don't have any of the specialists in those areas, I can see great partnerships with that. I'm a little lead editor, I'm not in a director position to make those calls.
Just to follow up on that, I was recently at ALA, and one of the themes for collection development was the idea of libraries collecting even less print by collaborating with other libraries, such as Columbia and Cornell, are going to look at different subject areas, and they'll just share, they'll just jointly own something instead of both purchasing it. And I wonder if Harvard has had any discussions about that, given that we kind of know the model's unsustainable. There's, as you say, there's more print things being published, there's more electronic things being published. We can't keep paying for everything. If we talked about collaborating with other large research institutions?
Yes, we are considering that very seriously. It's one of the major themes of the task force that the provost set in motion this last semester. But it goes beyond that, and certainly I hope that Harvard and MIT will have what I call not just collaboration and cooperation, but deep collaboration and cooperation. One way you can do that, and that's what Cornell and Columbia have done, is to create a third entity, which would be a kind of not-for-profit corporation of some sort, that would be the intermediary. And apparently that's a way to protect yourself legally from any suggestion that you are conspiring in constraint of trade. But as you know, we have to be extremely careful when we talk with other libraries, especially if it's a matter of trying to reduce expenditures for acquisitions of any kind.
Because I always try to hang out with Bob, remind him not to violate antitrust laws. Then we bring Phil along if we really need an antitrust company.
I think I would gladly go to jail if I could bring down the subscription.
We didn't hear that. It's not willful. Don't worry. And that's off the record. We're deleting that part. Just keep going. Some other topic.
I just wanted to mention it before. We've been talking a lot about the cost of content and access to content. We haven't talked about the cost and access to metadata for that content. So in addition to paying for the content, we also actually pay for metadata. And more, some of the sources of that metadata are trying to put restrictions on us in terms of what we can do with the metadata once we get it. Just as an example, we subscribe to the 18th century collections online, the e-resource that has hundreds of thousands of documents from the 18th century. We don't have, though, the individual title levels represented in our catalog with links to the individual pieces, because the vendor is trying to sell us that data, which we're willing to buy, but they want to put restrictions on what we can do with it, like even so far as saying how many databases we can keep it in internally. So, and I don't know if you're, I know you've heard about the OCLC policy about redistribution and reuse of records, but more and more it seems that there are, in addition to just the content, it's also the metadata describing that content that people are putting restrictions on and trying to get make money on, even though libraries are actually creating a lot of that metadata.
Yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned this, so please don't hand away the microphone, because I'd like to ask you the question about it. I mean, I'm a great reader of 18th century collections online, actually. It's a fabulous service. But I was not aware of this dimension to the problem, that is, inadequate metadata or charging a lot for metadata or putting restrictions on it. Could you explain that a little more fully, because I would like to work on this.
So when we purchase or subscribe to one of these e-resources like that one, and there's other ones, sometimes vendors actually give you the metadata for free, because that's really the best way that users know how to get to those individual titles. So it's in their best interest to give it to you for free, because it increases access, increases discoverability of those titles.
And I want to say Springer is one of those that give you records for free.
You also get what you pay for.
Yes.
Other vendors will actually, the records are sometimes pretty good, but they'll also charge you for it. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, because we are getting something out of it, because you can never afford to individually catalog all of those titles. But then they try to say you cannot reuse this data. Once you put it in your catalog, that's the only thing you can do with it. You have to make sure that nobody gets the records from you. And so part of what someone who's going to be here today but couldn't come, Noelle Ryan, part of her job is to help make sure that nobody at Harvard signs licenses like that for MARC data, for the catalog data, to make sure that we don't say, don't promise anything that we're not going to abide by. But it's similar to the way that Harvard has their own policy with OCLC. We have our own agreement with OCLC that's different than their standard agreement, and that's something that I think that, you know, the folks, I think it's 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I had to fight to get for us, but other libraries weren't so fortunate and do have that restricted clause with their OCLC contract where they can't share data.
Thank you. No, that's very helpful. I just was ignorant of the metadata side to all of this.
One other just related note, as I was looking at the Twitter stream over here, Dan Gilmore, one of the former Berkman Fellows and a partner of ours, was saying he won't use Wolfram Alpha, which is a search engine, because they're claiming copyright in search results, which, I mean, you can imagine this is just a different variant of that same extraordinary concern. Anyway. Adam Holland, you've been tweeting up a storm back there. Do you want to channel any of that in the room?
Well, a lot of this is still very new to me in terms of the academic publishing ecosystem. But I wondered if you might return to what Bobby was saying earlier about trying to set up some kind of a parallel track. I mean, I was frankly flabbergasted by the number you put for what you spend on subscriptions every year, and see in conjunction with your number for profits. I mean, that's an awful lot of consumer surplus being captured. And it seems if, and apropos what John was saying about large institutions with enough reputational clout to make it stick, they get together and say, look, you know, we're each spending $1.5 million a year on these things. It'd be cool that, I'm not saying it could happen overnight, or that there wouldn't be any bumps in the road, but don't you think it might be possible to able to weld something together that could make manifest the sort of things that David is talking about when he's saying, you know, why do people need to be published and sell? Because Because, I mean, maybe I'm clearly a tyro, but, you know, I thought one of the whole big things about the digital revolution is that we are all publishers now, and I've got a publishing studio right here in front of me. So what is it that does cost so much? I mean, the author writes it. I understand that they want to be in sell, but, you know, it can't be costing that much. And if you could provide the parallel track, let's say, you know, this is the imprimatur of the Harvard University Library System, you can get just as much academic reputational street cred, as it were. You know, why aren't you cutting the middleman, which is what I understand also here to be, maybe I'm wrong about that, out of the loop?
Perhaps you have an answer to that.
I actually just want to amplify that. I'm Jonathan King. I am a law student here. And coming from the world of law review publishing, I was absolutely astounded to hear the $3,000 figure for publishing a single article. I managed a law review that a law school in India is publishing this summer. And we pay $3,000 to an American publisher to compose the entire book, about 300 pages. So that just makes me wonder why it conceivably costs so much to put out these, for an individual article in something like a scientific journal.
I cannot come up with an adequate answer to that. It's my own ignorance, so I have to beg forgiveness. I do think that when the Public Library of Science Biology charges $2,850 for one article, that they know what they're doing. They're not inflating their costs. It's an open access journal, and they're not trying to make profit. So it could be that in some fields, there are very great costs. I don't understand how that happens. I happen to have a daughter-in-law who's a physicist, and she publishes in some of these expensive journals, and they have such fabulous software and programs, so that she really gives them copy that is ready to be published. It's just terrific stuff. So I'm bewildered myself, but I honestly think that in the case of something like the PLOS journals, that they are not inflating their costs, but I can't tell you why. But I do accept the point that it's not rational the way things are now, that we ought to be able to shift things in the direction of open access such that they would be less expensive. And one of the arguments for actually subsidizing the processing fees is that if we can get a conversion of journals to open access publishing with moderate prices, in the long run, we would pay less in the form of subscriptions. So in fact, we would save money because we would our acquisitions budget would show that we're spending much less for these wildly expensive journals as more and more open access journals come online. So I think that there is an evolution in that direction, but we are again in a transitional period where we're hurting on both fronts.
So we're at 3 o'clock, which is when others are going to join us, I think, and people here may want to take a quick break. Mansoor, do you have a very short comment?
Well, I'm just thinking the cost maybe perhaps has to do with experts, professionals who are providing a format for these informations or for the articles that will be accessible to the users. For example, if you pay a cataloger who used to do that, I mean, it's changing, $65,000-$70,000 a year to provide maybe 2 or 3 books a day, provide access to the material, to the books that are available in the law school library. That's a lot of money. That's the lot of,
You're right. So I think the people costs are likely the costs in electronic publishing, right? So it may be editors, it may be paying people to coordinate peer review and so forth.
But in any event, Bob, if you would, do you want a last word on this?
No. I think we all share sentiments. Maybe there wasn't enough dissent.
There wasn't much dissent,
but there's such an overwhelming
clarity.
Problem,
right.
And we're casting about for solutions. So if you get bright ideas, send them our way.
Right, and at other schools, please join us or help us figure out how to do better what we're doing on open access, because it's clearly a big push and certainly part of the response to the issues that the Google Book settlement puts into our heads. So thanks everyone for joining the session, and we'll just sort of assume it's a 5 or 10 minute break, and as other people come in here, we'll restart at, say, 3:10.